Donald in the Kitchen talks about food. Donald in the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald in the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on
Community Radio.
Welcome to the Donald in the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here once a week around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions. And we are here at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames, the center of Iowa, the center of the country, the center of it all. Thank you for joining us at our kitchen table today. Well, happy spring, finally. I wish to report that, yes, it is spring. We had the equinox yesterday.
Yesterday. Mm-hmm. Yes. The cardinals are thrilled. The robins are bouncing around in the woods.
They're back. I hear that as far as robins are concerned, they're kind of the first wave. It's kind of the young males that come first and do their flitting around. So more power to them. We're looking forward to more spring. That's good. And I wish to report that I got my box of chicks, baby chicks in the mail.
Oh, goody, we'll have eggs again.
Yeah, here we go. We had kind of a long, dry winter, and I got 25 new little chickens, and yes, they do come in the mail.
That is just such a still incomprehensible thing to me, right?
I used to pick them up at the feed store locally, but yes, you can. They are sent by the mail, and so three cheers for the hatcheries that do all the hard work.
And they all arrived intact, alive.
They're little. They're hardy little things. Oof. They're out peeping and eating, and but they were great. They look, well, you never know. There's always attrition, but the first day they're doing good. So all my...
What'd you say? You got 25 of them?
25.
Excellent.
Yeah. Just enough.
You got the best varieties for the minks to eat?
Oh, yeah. I'm sure that they like those. You end up ordering the same old varieties, well, sort of, that you always have, because you know what does good, and you know what you like to look at all year. You know it. So, because I like my chicken. So, three cheers to the hatcheries, and three cheers to the post office. Another...
Do we still have several big hatcheries in Iowa, or at least one?
Oh, no, there's quite a few.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, quite right. A few. Well, you know, a bunch.
Okay.
I ordered from a hatchery west of Ames, and there's some elsewhere. So, chicks are there to be had. Anyway, here at the Donald in the Kitchen table, we often talk about corn, and we had a show about corn a month or so ago.
Yes, we're really corny, corn-centric here in Iowa. Funny about
that. Somehow that topic comes up a lot, and we realize at the end of the show, there's always more to talk about, because there's corn, but then there's more corn. So today we're going to be talking about masa. What's masa, Donna?
Well, I've been looking forward to this show for a while because I'm on a roll with this one. I've had so much fun. So masa is when it's South American, Latin American traditional way of preparing the corn. So it's basically they take the corn and they soak it, and there's certain varieties. They soak it in some kind of lye or wood ash or some alkaline. It's alkalinization. The process is called nixtamalization.
So you soak it in
water with whatever you're using to make it very alkaline, and it eventually loosens the outer core of the corn. It also does some other things nutritionally that make more of the nutrition in the corn bioavailable for human consumption, because you know, unlike a cow, we don't have five stomachs. And so it's a process for making corn. You can grind corn, and then you end up with corn flour or the kind of things we make corn bread out of, or polenta. But if you want to make masa, which is what they make tortillas out of, among other things, and tamales, and all kinds of other things, the masa, you have to nixtamalize the corn first. So you soak it in this lime and water mixture, and then you rinse it all off, including it takes off the extra outside kernels, and then it's ground.
As I understand it, you boil it a little bit?
Yes.
Okay.
Some heat is applied.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, it is. Because there's a picture in here of things
right,
boiling.
Right. So the masa is traditionally, this was all done by hand and in pots, and then it's pounded. Now it's ground in big grinders with certain kinds of very specific stones, the way you press the masa. And, of course, the kind of corn that you use makes a huge difference as well. So what we got excited about is there's a new-ish company called Masienda, and they have a book out called, of all things, masa. Now, the kind of masa that is most widely available to us is then the nixtamalized ground corn is then dried. So if you're buying masa flour or mixture, it is not the same as buying corn flour.
Yeah, see, I learn things all the time.
Like you cannot make tortillas out of, you could make corn cakes, but you cannot make tortillas or tamales out of straight corn flour. It has to be nixtamalized. So, and there are masas that are widely available. Now, what Masienda has done is gone deep into the heart of Mexico and gotten some heirloom corns. So they sell the corns so you can nixtamalize it yourself. They even make a nixtamalizer, the press that grinds it for, you know, like if you have a restaurant or some more, because the big ones are huge, huge, huge. They make a sort of, I wouldn't exactly call it a home model. I'm not going to buy one. They're like $1,800 or something. You know, I'm not, that's out of my, yeah, it's out of my range for, well, it's ridiculous. I don't use it enough. I'll just buy their already processed masa. But you have to remember that masa was originally all ground by hand between stones. So
Right. Reading about the original process here, again, women getting up really early in the morning and feeding the fire, bringing in the firewood and cooking their corn and adding the lime, adding the alkali and letting it soak. And
yeah, it takes a few days to do all this.
Yeah,
right.
Okay, and then you rinse it and drain it. And then all those pictures of the South American women grinding, usually on their knees, with the stone back and forth. I guess I never looked closely. What they're grinding is not dry corn. It is this cooked mixture.
Right.
Yeah.
For the masa. Now, hominy is nixtamalized. Now, Americans ate a lot of corn too, even in the, you know, not just the Latin Americans, but Americans ate a lot of corn. Polenta is not nixtamalized, but the hominy was. So I guess that means grits, which are made from hominy. There must be a difference in between grits and polenta.
Ooh. No, I thought it was just the grind. See, something else to look into, but see, there we go.
Right, that's a little conundrum. I mean, I cook polenta all the time, and I think it's just with the Iowa corn that's not been nixtamalized. But I think hominy, which must mean grits, the kind you buy in the package that you cook up into, you know, breakfast grits and stuff, that must be nixtamalized. We'll have to check that one out. Anyway, this is all really, you know, we live in the epicenter of corn growing here in Iowa. And we've talked about it on the show because I've been really watching this story very closely, and it is quite a story about the trade disagreement between Mexico and the U.S. And we've talked about this a lot. So it is ongoing, right? And I'm sorry, but, you know, I am not proud of my American trade, the people running this discussion. They're being real kind of, sorry, I don't like what they're doing.
Well, it seems like it is not a new thing because I was reading about the history of masa and corn, which goes back thousands of years.
Yeah. And, it's almost that this discussion that we're having again is some kind of colonialization, because the U.S. delegation is, you know, they sound like they're protecting American farmers, but really they're not. Who they're protecting are the genetically modified bioengineered corporations that have patents on the corn seeds. So what the trade disagreement is about is Mexico has been making noises for about 10 or 15 years. In Mexico, they have, especially in deep in the south, like Oaxaca, and there are a lot of indigenous farmers who are growing heirloom seed varieties. Now, corn, as we all know in Iowa, the pollen from corn travels widely and easily changes the nature of one plant. So these heirloom seeds that have been grown in small pockets here and there and are, some of them have been cultivated for thousands of years to have like red corn, blue corn, you know, and it is specific varietal heirloom seed work that has been done by these indigenous farmers. And when Mexico started importing the GMO corn, some of those began to be contaminated with the GMO qualities, and that changed the nature of their corn. So the Mexican government, for a while, was one of the first to say, no, we need to protect, because Mexico considers itself kind of like the home of corn, you know? It's very important, still in their diet. So there have been a lot of motions to protect these heirloom varieties in Mexico. And the other issue that the Mexican government is saying is they want to begin to get glyphosate, which is the herbicide widely used on all of the corn, all the genetically modified corn, because it's been bred to tolerate it. Mm-hmm. They want to get glyphosate out of the human food system in Mexico. Well, I say bravo. Now, we're having huge fights about this in this country, and more evidence is coming to light that the glyphosate that we are using in higher and higher quantities, particularly in Iowa, is not good for the environment, and it's not good for humans. It does certain, they initially claim that glyphosate kind of goes through the human system and doesn't do anything. Well, what we're finding out is that it affects the microbiome and the bugs in the human digestive system. They're now settling cases in California, where glyphosate has been attributed to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and things like that. So it's beginning to change. But part of the disagreement in the trade situation is, of course, the U.S. negotiators are claiming that glyphosate is completely harmless, and the Mexican government is saying, no, it's not completely harmless. So at this point in the negotiations, because the U.S. is threatening now at this point very seriously to bring a trade disagreement to the WTO, a lot of it is going to hinge on a wait and see about the glyphosate sort of thing. So that's part of it.
Yeah. I want to mention a little thing about, we're taking a lot of our information and a lot of our excitement about this topic from a book called MASA, Techniques, Recipes, and Reflections on a Timeless Staple, by the author and entrepreneur Jorge Gaviria.
Or in Mexican, it would be Jorge, maybe, right?
Very good. In Iowa, I say George, but okay.
Well, yeah, so anyway, this young man, his history is that he started working at Stone Barns in New York State, where, of course, they grow everything in the farm, they really localize, they're really in traditional varieties and that sort of thing. So when he, after he had worked there for a while, he decided he wanted to have his own business in the food industry, and he began his exploration of the Mexican corns and the masa, and he went deep into Oaxaca and all over Mexico and parts of Central America, and he produced this beautiful book, which Lana and I have been having so much fun with. It explains about nixtamalization. The whole back half of the book is every possible, not just Mexican, but all these traditional uses of masa. Like, masa can be made into, it's as ubiquitous as pasta. You know how pasta comes in a million shapes? So masa can be dumplings. Masa, of course, can be tortillas, and it can be tamales. And, there are probably, 30 other recipes in there.
Yeah.
So we're going to have a lot of fun trying this.
We'll do that.
I have to say that Masienda has a great website. That's Masienda, with where you can learn a lot about it. Like, they have videos all over the website showing how it's made and their trips to, I mean, it's, it's not just a place to order product. It is a place to really educate yourself. And you can do fine on the website and not even buy the book. But we are having so much fun with the book.
Good.
So we did order the press.
Oh,
the tortilla press. Okay, I'm careful about buying kitchen gadgets because, you know, there's so many things that end up being useless. But they have a tortilla press in there. It's called the Doña Rosa Tortilla Press. It says, the best tortilla press, according to not just us, but also the experts at Epicurus, Servirer, American's Test Kitchen, and others. It comes from the heart of Oaxaca's Central de Abastos, where Doña Rosa has been selling her design to locals for longer than she can recall. Its pure heft, thanks to hot-rolled steel and tight calibration, make a range of tortilla thicknesses possible. Plus, it's been finished with FDA-grade power-coated stateside in 3 stylish hues. So it's big. It's like the Cadillac of tortilla presses, but oh, is it fun to use.
Yeah.
Now, here's the thing with tortilla presses. And I learned this from the website. You take a thin plastic bag, like the kind you put your produce in at the grocery store. You cut it in half, and you put it one piece on the bottom of the press. Then you put your masa ball on another, and you put another one on the top. And then you put it in your press, because that peels off and leaves then your tortilla does not stick to the press. People have used saran wrap. It's really messy. This is one time where I have to say I'm happy to use a plastic bag. Maybe the only time. But now the other thing is, if you don't want to buy the press, you can all, and he says this in the book, you can press tortillas between 2 large books. Of course, with the plastic, because you don't want them sticking to the books. So anybody can make the tortillas without the press, but the press is really fun.
It is. It is. It's a real, and what's the, again, beautiful pictures of traditional Central American, Mexican.
There's a whole little.
And you see that press being used in those kitchens, so it must be good.
Anyway. Yeah, there's a whole little video about Doña Rosa and the shop where they're made and her family doing it and the whole, you know, it's fun. And there are a lot of other videos about how you nixtamalize, about, he's big on making tortillas that puff. His whole video about how to make the tortilla puff.
Oh, see, that is something to strive for.
Yeah, absolutely.
It have never happened to me.
No,
okay.
It's not.
Okay.
It hasn't happened yet. So I ordered the press, and then they also sell the nixtamalized masa in 4 colors of traditional corns. Red, blue, yellow, and white. So, of course, I got that, too. So I've been making tortillas. I have not reached the point yet where I can make them puff. It has to do with how much water you mix into the corn. I'm not there yet. I'm working on it.
Good, good. And speaking of corn, here's something that from the book Masa. It's about that term that we've actually probably used here on the Don Alana Kitchen before. Landrace corn, which kind of means the original stuff. And here's a little bit about what Jorge went down there to find, okay? Down to Central America to find. In Mexico, there are 59 or 60, depending on whom you ask, core landraces or breeds of corn that constitute the basis for the wealth of our globe's corn system. A more specific designation than heirloom, a landrace is locally adapted, traditional variety of domesticated species. In the case of maize, a plant that has developed over time to reflect the natural environment from which it comes. The landrace is an open-pollinated cultivar that grows through selective breeding. And selective breeding has been going on for a long time. Corn has been part of the human community for a long time. And we
landrace varieties that Mexico is trying to protect.
Right.
As well they should.
As well they should. Within the core landraces, there are thousands of varieties that exist in between. In fact, more than 30,000 accessions.
Right, because this is the cross-pollinization,
right. Back and forth have been collected from Mexico in recent decades. So it should come as no surprise that every corn variety from the corn that has been exported to Italy, to the stuff that comes to North America, to the number two yellow corn up here that was kind of the field corn, to Bloody Butcher of the United States, that's a variety up here, is a descendant of Mexican corn in some form. And they're spread out across the country of Mexico, spanning diverse climates and doing well in lots of different places. And these land races are maintained mainly by the smallholder, small farmers, because you kind of got to keep this stuff localized. I hear corn pollen is pretty prolific.
It travels well.
It goes all over the place, and it's really easy to mix up your varieties. And traditionally, milpa is the word for small farm or small garden in Spanish, and it refers to their, we've talked about it before, the complement of corn, beans, and squash grown together, and that's where some of this good, that's where some of these good varieties come from. Now, when we made tortillas at Donna's house this past week, and she had these four varieties of corn, so really we had four colors of
We tried them. I have to say, so I've been, and after we kind of did our tortilla party making, I've twice also just done it on my own. You know, it, you can, even if you're just making them for yourself, if you, it's kind of using their masa, it's about equal parts water to the masa flour, and you know, so you can, you know, make a quarter cup was enough for one person serving. And it's so fast. You just pour the water into the bowl with the masa, mix it with your hands until it gets kind of a little bit sticky, but not too sticky. He talks about it, and I'm still trying to figure this out, because if you roll the ball in your hand, and the ball is, what do you think, an inch and a half across maybe? It makes small tortillas. You can make bigger ones, but I'm starting with the small ones. And he says in the book and on the videos on the website, which you can watch for free, then if you smash it in your hand and the sides crack a little bit, it's not quite wet enough. But it's also very easy to get it too wet, and then it's sticky and hard to deal with. So I'm still fooling around, because apparently with the right wetness, getting the puff becomes more possible. So I've been working with the white one, which I must say their white corn is, I think, flavor-wise, there's not a huge difference in flavors between them, although there is some. The white corn on the Masieta site is probably the closest in flavor to most of the masa that you can buy. Like King Arthur Flour has a masa you can order, and Bob's Red Mill has a masa, and then there's the standard one. What's the brand name of Molinito? Or no, wait, what's that standard one that's everywhere that most people use?
I don't know.
Anyway, you can find it. But their flavors are four different colors. So the yellow, oh yeah.
Is that it?
Maseca. Maseca is the classic one, right? Ah. That you can find in, you know, Spanish grocery stores and certainly all over Mexico. My favorite one, I think, is going to be the red or the yellow. Yeah. I like both of them. Of course, the color is delightful, too. Except, I have to say, I must not really love blue corn. Maybe it's just the color, because it comes out looking gray. It's not, doesn't look blue to me, although the taste is fine. There is no bad masa from Masienda. They're all really, really good.
And one thing I learned is that the color varies a little bit depending on the alkali. The alkali can affect if the blue is black or gray or blue. So,
right.
You're dealing with magic here, folks. We're dealing with corn. We're dealing with masa. Today on the Donna Lana Kitchen, and this is KHOI, you're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the Heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're exploring corn today. Corn, it's all around Iowa, and it's pretty much around a lot of other places, too. And we really haven't talked about masa much. Masa is that magic stuff that makes itself into tortillas. And who doesn't love a good tortilla? Of course, growing up in the Midwest, it's not really something. It's something I had to be introduced to.
Yeah, we're just having exploration ourselves. We're growing into it.
Yeah, this is great. This is great. And one thing about there was kind of the original way of making masa, which we find out is really intensely labor-intensive with the soaking.
If you make it by hand, yes.
Alkali, making it by hand, and soaking and starting from the original corn kernels. But then people started playing around in the late 1800s, around the turn of the century, there about 1900, with, well, wait a minute, maybe we can kind of speed things up here, because we're getting into the industrial age here. And coming up with masa harina, which means that masa flour, corn masa flour, they took the already nixtamalized stuff.
You almost said it there, nixtamalized. Very good, Lana.
Practice, yes. And dry it down. And actually, people realized it was actually a pretty good deal. Because,
convenient, much.
Yeah,
you know.
Very good. And also in the places that grew corn well, like Mexico, the climate for drying things wasn't too bad either. So people would make it ahead of time, and then they would dry it down and sell it in bags.
And like flour, basically.
Like flour. That's kind of how we are here. And, of course, just like the other story of corn, big money and big flour and big commodity producers get into it, and there's all kinds of standardization and money changing hands, and that there's a whole story of that too. But the people that started this thing out were kind of good. I want to mention one person here, Masa Harina. As Mexico was grappling with the advent of mechanized milling and tortilla baking, through the early decades of the 20th century, first within the capital city of Mexico, and eventually throughout the rural landscape, the seeds of another kind of masa revolution were being sown in the United States. In 1896, Jose Bartolomo Martinez, a native of Mexico raised in Texas, opened the first fresh U.S. masa mill in San Antonio. Noting how quickly his fresh masa dried in the Southwest, that was a big deal, he thought, this is good. Let's dehydrate this freshly milled masa at low enough moisture content.
Make it shelf stable, yeah.
He realized the masa could be safely held for months. And more and more people in the United States were getting turned on to this wonderful thing called masa and tortillas and Mexican food. And so then with the simple reintroduction of water to his product and a quick mix, you could make your own tortillas. It was magic. It was magic. And so he started a big market. And it hit the local Texas markets in 1908 and went gangbusters for a few years. And he kept going on for a while, but also he kind of backed out of the industry after a while. But before he did, he realized that sometimes he had a bunch of extra masa left over besides selling all of his big quantities. And he is at least credited in the United States with doing the first marketing of the corn chip.
Huh? Tortilla chips.
See?
Oh, yeah.
Huh? And I think there could be a statue someplace.
Yep, yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and then he was trying to push his corn chips. Everybody liked them. And he's the one that came up with the three-corner shape. See, huh? He figured out
that was the best thing there.
And he was also credited with making tortilla chips and guacamole and salsa, as we know it, available to restaurants as another thing he could sell. So
this
about,
was early in the last century.
Yes, yes. No, maybe didn't get to Iowa right then. But it was, at least it was a big deal in
Tex-Mex.
Texas. Yeah, it was. It was. It, as demand quickly grew, he created a full product line and went great for a while. And then long about, he really started going great guns in 1919 under the Tamalina brand. However, Martinez's tortilla chips gave rise to fierce competition. By 1934, a former customer of Martinez, Elmer Doolin, founded a little company called Frito, which sort of took off. And Frito is the Spanish word for a little fried thing. So, and it certainly is. So
there you have your Fritos.
Somebody had to invent this stuff.
That's the Americanization of the corn.
Yeah, it was.
Yep.
The corn
chip. Frito-lay, there you go.
The corn chip. There you go. Ha. Huh. Well, speaking of chips and salsa and guac, and tell us about all the good stuff that kind of goes into or on top of, or depending
well,
on how you hold
it. In the Masa book, there's a lot of wonderful recipes that are well written, well explained, beautifully photographed. I in my culinary experience, so of course I lived in Los Angeles for a good number of years, and one of the wonderful things about living in LA is that the Mexican border at Tijuana is about a 2-hour drive. So if you are wanting a vacation, a quick weekend vacation where you completely change cultures, you just get in the car and you drive. I used to say that border between San Diego and Tijuana was maybe, and I could be accurate about this, one of the most drastic cultural changes on the planet. Because, you know, you're on the San Diego side and it's all, you know, suburban, kind of modern, you know, beach towns and, you know, lovely, lovely, lovely. But you drive across the border at the Tijuana border crossing, it is insanely different very quickly. Now we used to just, there is a highway that drives right through Tijuana out to the ocean and down the coast to Ensenada. And it is a beautiful drive. We used to just like zip right through Tijuana and never stop there because it's kind of crazy. And if you're on there for, you know, a 3 or 4 day vacation, you want to get down to the beautiful part of the Baja. And the coast along the drive down to Ensenada, it's a beautiful 4-lane highway. And the views of the coast and the little fishing towns along the way and the food. Oh, my goodness. The fish market in Ensenada is, you know, I've never seen a better. I mean, there are some wonderful fish markets all over the world, but the one in Ensenada, you know, it's fresh off the boats. The seagulls are flying around. The shrimp and they're called spot prawns that you can buy around there. The mussels, the lots of tuna, all kinds of, it's just fabulous. And so the Baja tradition for tacos is very specific. I mean, it's desert. Really, really desert there. So when I make tacos, and this is what we did the other night, we had some shrimp. We fried those up. And we also had, you know, the usual, I made one, a pork mixture and a beef mixture. And then I made several salsas. I actually just took a mild salsa, the kind you buy in the jar, right? Added some fresh lemon juice and chopped in some cilantro. It's pretty close. You know, you doll it up a little bit. Then I made another one where I took the dried ancho chilies and soaked them in predominantly fresh orange juice, a shot of grapefruit juice, and a shot of lime juice. And I just let those sit overnight and soften and then, you know, blitz them up with my immersion blender. That made a great salsa. Not too hot. And then Lana did the best thing. We made a tomatilla salsa because Lana grows tomatillas, and of course she roasts them and freezes them.
Yeah, the roasting, well, before you put them in the freezer, That's a good thing to do. And yeah. then you get the bag out of the freezer and you say, here, Donna, here's some tomatillas. What did you do with them?
So let me think if I can remember. I put, put in a dab of garlic. What else did I put in it? More than garlic. Oh, maybe some oregano. I actually looked up, one of my favorite books is The Border Grill Cafe, which is big in Los Angeles, two chefs that are old friends of mine. And the book is maybe 20 years old, at least. So they have really good combinations for these things. But I'm trying to think what I put. I know I put garlic. I did. I put a little bit of jalapeno in it. And I was trying not to make it too hot. So if you cut your jalapeno under running water and scrape all of the seeds out, you will reduce the heat if you are cooking for a group that doesn't love a lot of heat. So we had that one. Then in the Baja, they have something they put on their tortillas called crema, which is basically a mixture of sour cream and mayonnaise with a little lime juice in it. So I made some of that. And then we made tamarindo.
Oh, now this is a good
thing.
This was
fun. This is a beverage. So if you're down in the Baja, the two main beverages, besides beer, of course, that go, the non-alcoholic ones are tamarindo and horchata. So horchata is a sweetened rice-made drink, which you can actually, you can buy them in aseptic containers and make your own. It's sweetened. But the other one is tamarindo. So it's straight tamarind and sugar. I just went to the local Indian store and bought a block of tamarind, which comes with, so tamarind is a fruit that grows in a pod, and it has these big seeds in it. So if you buy it, it's already, the pod has been removed, but it's a sticky mass of seeds and fibers and stuff like that.
It looks kind of like dates. Sort of. It's
glom together, dark. Yeah, but it's messier than dates because it's got seeds in it and stuff. So what you do is you put that in some water and let it soak till the block of stuff breaks up. And then you cook it a little bit. And then you add sugar. And then you put it through, I use my, what's that called? My food mill, basically. It's like you're pressing the pulp and leaving behind the seeds and the sticky bits. So you do that, and then you mix it with water, and you just keep going till you get a nice beverage. And then we served it with some optional Hornitos tequila. Mm. It was delicious. It was really, really good. It makes a wonderful non-alcoholic beverage or a wonderful cocktail. So we had that. In the Baja, they do not put cheese on their tortillas, and they do not put lettuce on their tortilla. So what they do is they have really thinly sliced cabbage mixed with cilantro. I made some of that to go on it so you get that crunchy vegetable thing. And it's sort of, you put all these little dishes out and everybody makes what they want. So what else? I think that was all. And some limes cut up so you can squeeze more lime on. I think that was all the ingredients, right?
It was lovely.
Yeah, it was really, really delicious. Sorry, rice and beans.
That was good too.
Yeah, I used brown basmati rice, and I just put in some oregano, cumin, some chopped red peppers, some onions, some garlic, and so there was rice. And then the beans were kind of the same thing. I cooked the beans down with, I did put epazote in the beans, which is very Mexican. And of course, Mexican oregano. Some bay leaves are very Mexican. In fact, there's a special bay leaf, which I had ordered from, Burlap and Barrel. They are now selling a Caribbean bay leaf, which is a slightly different than the Mediterranean one. And so I used that one. I like that for like rice pudding and, sweet and savory things both. So we had the rice, the beans, then you had your option of the pork, the beef, or the shrimp. Then you had three different salsas. Salsa just means sauce in Spanish. So we had the three different ones and cabbage and the crema.
It was It's lovely. Besides everybody with their hands in the bowl and,
oh, yeah,
and
we
making
were,
things, we taking were just, turns.
Now, the thing is, if you're making a lot of tortillas, you need to kind of wrap them up in a tea towel because they do dry out fairly mm-hmm. quickly. But you love to eat them hot off the griddle. There are some tricks with your griddle. It's better to have the griddle pretty hot. Not too hot, but let it heat up a little bit before you start flinging the tortillas on it. I was reading in another book, Flatbreads and Flavor, she was saying initially to have it on a less hot grill and then for 15 seconds and then immediate flip it onto the hot grill. But we just went straight for the hot griddle. No oil.
Aha, I wouldn't have mentioned it.
You
no
can
oil.
Use a cast iron pan. You can use, you know, the traditional pan is called a comal, I think, which you can also buy on Macienda
well,
if you're so inclined.
Well,
but we just used what we had. My stove is one of those stoves that has five burners, and the central one is like a griddle. Most people use them for pancakes, but we put that on and heated it up pretty high. And so we were flipping the tortillas out, and they were being eaten as fast as we could make them.
Oh, we did our best, I tell you. Thank you, Donna. It was a lovely evening. I want to mention this is KHOI, and this is the Donna Lena Kitchen. You can find out more at www.khoyfm.org, more about this fine radio station. And I want to mention another sign of spring. Yes, my chicks have arrived, but also, for those of you who like to work hard, carry a lot of heavy sap, move a lot of firewood, thanks to all of you who do maple syrup this time of year. It's a wonderful time of year for those of us who enjoy the sweetness from trees. So, yes, it is maple syrup time. Welcome back. We're talking about good food once a time. We always do that. And we started out talking about corn and masa. We ended up talking about tacos because what a nice thing to do with corn. It's a long, ancient process, and it comes down to us today.
Yeah, and we'll be trying tamales soon. Which I have to say, I've never made my own tamales. So.
Well, neither have I. I mean, my goodness, I was
right, we're Midwestern girls. What do we know?
What do we know about tamales? You know, you make cornbread.
That's
maybe,
right. Lots
that's
of cornbread.
That's about it.
Okay, yeah. So we're gonna embark upon a tamale adventure shortly.
Good. Along with this, the taco evening, of course.
Oh yeah, the dessert.
We had dessert. So, in keeping with the maple syrup season. Donna, what did you make?
Well, Lana and I often follow this guy called The Forager Chef, and he has a book called The Forager or something like that. So he periodically sends out emails with what he's fuddling around with in the kitchen. And the latest one was black walnut maple ice cream. And I said, okay, we love actually both items. And Lana's farm is the epicenter of maple centers, sugar making here in central Iowa. So they're down there boiling down that syrup in the woods. And so I decided, in honor of this. So I took some of the local front yard maple syrup, very local, and I've tried to follow, I actually followed his recipe precisely, which I don't often do, but I thought, all right, I'm going to try it. He had a few tips in his ice cream recipe that I really liked. He said, for example, using maple syrup to make ice cream, the maple syrup has a lot of liquid in it, and it crystallizes the ice cream. So what you need to do is boil it down, which I did. So I boiled it. Of course, it's been boiled down, but I boiled it down further till it was kind of a sticky mess in the pan. And then you add a little corn syrup because that actually stabilizes the crystal formation. So I followed that part of the recipe. And then he had another trick that I liked, which I'm going to use in other ice creams. Instead of adding, so a typical ice cream recipe is kind of like a very loose custard, which is usually milk, cream, sugar, and egg yolks that you then put into your ice cream maker. So he said, and then this is true, if you, sometimes bits of egg yolk will curdle in the pudding mix, leaving little lumpy things. So people often solve that by actually straining the ice cream mix, which I think is a huge waste of time. And you lose a lot of that wonderful cream and thick mixture in the strainer itself. So his solution to that is using cornstarch and no eggs. So
I thought, no eggs.
No eggs. So I did it. I love it. I'm going to use that for making bases for ice cream in the future. I thought it was really good.
Oh, cornstarch. Well.
Cornstarch. I mean, and not doing the egg part. So this recipe that he has, you can find it on foragerchef.com. And he also, so you make the syrup, you cook it down, you add the cornstarch, then you add, he uses a lot of milk and half and half. No, not milk. Cream and half and half. It's creamier than usually I would, you know, I'm always going, oh, that's a lot of fat.
Danny, but it was really good.
It was really good. Really delicious, I have to say. And then you add the black walnuts. Now, he said you actually need to add the black walnuts while the pudding mixture is thick, because then that pulls some of the black walnut flavor further into the pudding mixture. And you have to let it sit in the refrigerator overnight, which I did. And it was very, very good. I was a little concerned. His ice cream maker that he shows in the picture is slightly different than mine. His has a different kind of paddle. And I was concerned that the walnuts would, typically in the kind of machine I use, you add the chunky bits at the very end and it just gets stirred in and not caught in the paddle. So I was thinking, okay, here we go. But it worked just fine. And it was delicious. So that recipe is foragerchef.com. And he talks about how black walnut ice cream is, you know, has been made in this country typically, I don't know, for a number of years. Like, he shows a picture of a Blue Bunny black walnut ice cream container, right?
There's a little note. Be careful. They sometimes have pictures of black walnuts on the cover, and the insides are other kind of walnuts. But because black walnuts are kind of hard to pick.
Well, and they use it. You can't really buy them in large commercial quantities, which I think is a good thing. They're very precious. So the walnuts that we used were hand-picked by Lana's husband, Joe. And he has a great video on this particular posting where he shows even, how to pick the walnuts. So I wanted Joe to watch it because he's got a good trick for it. You know, when you hand pick your nuts, sometimes you get a little piece of the shell in the mix. And when you use that for cooking and you bite into it, it's like, as Alan Burgo says, there goes grandma's dentures, right?
Yeah.
So that he has a trick for picking the pieces and briefly putting them in water and letting the shell parts sink to the bottom and then lifting them up. And so it was very good.
Good
and
job.
And all done with our local ingredients.
Good recipe, and good end to a good evening of good food. I want to end this show talking another little bit of thing about corn from the book Masa, Techniques, Recipes, and Reflections on a Timeless Staple. a fine book, Corn Facts. What's the difference between sweet corn and other corns? Field corn converts sugars into starch. Sweet corn has a gene that prevents this full conversion of sugar. Field corns do go through a sweet milky stage, and you can also eat them at the sweet milky stage, shelled and boiled. But they're mainly used for
ethanol.
Masa. Yeah, what? Yeah, for all that stuff.
The field corn around here is mainly used for ethanol.
Oh, that too. Thank you. That's not in here.
That's not in the book now, right?
I mean,
it's not the romantic part of the story, right?
And why are most tortillas made from white corn? One likely reason is because of a gradual attempt to eliminate the appearance of processed wheat. Oh, again, have that. Both in seed selection and bleaching during the production process, which was considered superior and even mandated by the Mexican government at one point.
So it's like having white flour.
Yeah,
kind
yeah. Of. However, mm-hmm. we're learning. We learn as we go along. This is good. Well, Donna, I had a good time today. Masa is a good invention.
Yes, Masienda is the name of the company. Just Google it, and there's so much information there available. You don't even have to buy the book.
Oh, it's good. It's good. So thank you for joining us around our kitchen table today. And also, Donna, we have a podcast, don't we?
Yes, if you want to listen to this same discourse around the kitchen table, you can go to Donna Lana Kitchen. That's one word, D-O-N-N-A-L-O-N-N-A, second word, kitchen. Any place you get your podcasts, and there we will be.
If you just can't get enough of us. So thank you for lending us your ears. Oh, ears, like ears of corn, Donna.
Yes.
Oh, very good. Okay, very good.
See, I told you we were corny.
We are. Thanks for putting up with this. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We come to you every Tuesday live at noon, and that show is repeated at 7 p.m. in the evening on Tuesday on this fine radio station, KHOIFM.org. And you can find us there, archive, you can stream us, and share us with friends, too. Do that. We had music by the Barn Owl Band today. You heard the tunes Magpie, Miller's Reel. We'll go out with Howlin' Bill. Yes, we will. Support this fine community radio station. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.